Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and you know how much we here at Slice of Sci-Fi love independent film, little indie horror movies, little indie sci-fi movies, and whenever I come across a really cool one, I have to tell you about it. So today we're going to be talking with writer and director Stephanie Joalland and producer Sean McConville, who have created a indie British sci-fi film called The Quiet Hour. It has just recently become available on video on demand on DVD here in the United States. And we're going to talk about this movie because I think it's really cool. Welcome to the show, Stephanie and Sean.
Hi, Summer.
Thanks for having us on.
Now, this movie, I'm going to read the description here. Humans are few and far between since Earth was invaded by an unseen extraterrestrial machines that harvest the planet's natural resources and relentlessly kill its inhabitants. In a remote part of the countryside where starved humans have become as dangerous as the alien machines hovering in the sky, a feisty 19-year-old girl, Sarah Connolly, sets out on a desperate attempt to fight back a group of bandits and defend her parents' farm, their remaining livestock, and the solar panels that keep them safe from the extraterrestrials. If she doesn't succeed, she will lose her only source of food and shelter, but if she resists, she and her helpless blind sibling will be killed. And if the mysterious intruder dressed like a soldier who claims he can help them turns out to be a liar, then the enemy may already be in the house. So that intrigued me from the beginning because you've got a science fiction, post-apocalyptic situation, a survival situation, and a little bit of intrigue.
So, yeah, the story came about because I wanted to direct my first feature film. So it had to be contained because I knew the budget would be rather small. So that's why, and I love science fiction, so I knew I had to find a story that would be easy to do, yet revolving around science fiction themes. So the story came about when I read The Birds by Daphne du Maurier, and which is very, very different from the actual film by Hitchcock. And it's really a survival story about a father and his kids trying to keep them safe in a world where birds are trying to kill human beings. And it's quite, and the story is very bleak, the actual short story, very, very, very different from Hitchcock's interpretation of it. So I guess that was the starting point, and the birds became spaceships. That we see in the sky. Obviously, I knew that because of the limitations of my budget, that I wouldn't be able to show much of the aliens. So they are more like a background. It's more like a science fiction background for the story, which is truly like almost like a Western in a way, because it's truly a survival story. So the core of it was truly that young girl trying to protect her estate from a bunch of marauders.
So how long did it take for you to actually come up with a script that you were comfortable shooting with?
I think it took about a year before I had something that my producers and exec producers thought that was a good screenplay, something we could do and we could do well on the budget.
I'll jump in. Stephanie worked very hard on the script, so a year is quite quick for the development process, but she was very determined to make her first feature. She worked very hard on the script, and we also had great consultancy advice from we both went to UCLA and studied screenwriting. So we had several mentors that we could go to with a script and get feedback from. So we were quite assured that the script was in a good development status. And then the thing that kind of backed that up was that once we started sending it to the agencies to get the cast, we had a lot of great responses, a lot of actors wanted to play these characters, especially the lead character, Sarah Connolly, who was ultimately played by Dakota Blue Richards. And then because the script was kind of sought after in the small indie world, so to speak, actually producing the film came together very quickly. It was a low budget film. We already had some people that wanted to help with the finance. It was private equity. And so really from when Stephanie had finished what we call a shooting script, a year later, we were literally playing at our first festival. So from start to finish, from the Stephanie's initial idea for the script to writing and developing it to financing it, producing the film, finishing post, and then premiering at our first festival was a two-year period.
Wow, that is really quick.
Yeah, so it doesn't always happen that way. But again, this film has minimal characters. It's very contained, but it's very high concept. It's very cleverly written in that we do see this alien presence in the sky. It's the backdrop to the story. A lot of people like that about the film, that it's a mystery, it's a metaphor. And as Stephanie said, the real story is about this young girl protecting her homestead, so to speak, her farm, in this apocalyptic world, amidst the backdrop of this alien invasion. So that allowed us to do a high concept sci-fi film, albeit on a low budget.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's very contained. Most of it takes place in and around the farmhouse, but you still manage to, through the use of this this stranger who wanders into their lives, you manage to get a sense for the scope of the devastation that the aliens have caused, because of he has a digital camera and they look through some of the pictures he's taken on his travel across the country, trying to find a new safer place to be. And I thought that was very cleverly done.
Yeah, that was the idea, to just get a sense, give the audience a sense of what happened in the last year leading to the story. And so thank you. Yeah, that was, I'm glad it worked for you.
Yeah, that was, you know, right from the outset, Stephanie had decided, with determination to make a first feature. And the thing that makes that easier, it's very difficult to make your first feature. The one thing that really helps is if the budget is not too big, too much of a risk for financiers and distributors and sales agents and all the business side of things. So Stephanie very cleverly created all these devices to show the world and tell the story and the conflict in that world and story through these clever devices that can be done, you know, relatively easy these days. And the other thing was seeing these giant pods in the sky that are essentially like massive oil rigs in the sky, mm-hmm. Stealing human resources. That was all done on blue screen. So again, that's another way of doing this type of imagery in post, where you have more time and you can get a team together that understand that, you know, this isn't a big movie where there's lots of money available for those. So we found an amazing visual effects artist that dedicated a serious amount of hours and time into creating that that look, which you see on the poster. And you see in several moments, events throughout the film.
And I really wanted the aliens to remain a mystery, because I'm often disappointed when I actually see in much bigger films, when I actually see the creatures. They always look better kind of in my mind, in my imagination, when I read a book. So hopefully the audience will like my choice of not showing the creatures.
Yeah, we often hear that one of the things that we hear a lot that people like about the film is like in a novel. Your imagination fills in the blanks, so to speak, or imagines the mystery, the things you cannot see. You're just hinted at. So that, you know, it seems that that actually, albeit it was designed to be made on a budget, that actually works in a storytelling way to create suspense and mystery in the film.
And Lily was very inspired by A.C. Clarke. There is a book, I think it's Welcome to Rama, where we see the a cube up in up there in universe, and a bunch of astronauts explore it, but we never get to see the actual creatures. We just see the what they built up, but we don't know if they're around or not. And till the end of the book, it remains a mystery and gripping because, you know, it's again, it's left to your imagination.
Yeah, and actually, interestingly, you know, 18 months or a couple of years after we made our film, you know, in a way, in a much bigger, more grandiose Hollywood budget way, you know, they use the same kind of device in Arrival, in that you have these
pods.
I think there's about 11 or 12 in Arrival of these big pods or spaceships hovering in the sky. Obviously, you know, they go further into the story where the humans go inside those pods and communicate with the aliens. But just that imagery is not too dissimilar to what we did on our tiny little film in comparison. Mm-hmm. And in fact, at the end of The Quiet Hour, how I won't spoil the ending, but there is a very big similarity as to how the aliens actually leave this dimension or this atmosphere, whatever way you want to look at it. And that's interesting because there is some similarities, which again is indicative of the fact that even though we made a small contained film with a small cast, it is a high concept story with big themes.
What struck me as increasing or adding to the tension on the ground was the aliens, their machines remained an enigma for the entire film. There was no attempt to contact them. There's no interaction with them other than the little smaller ships that go out hunting down humans whenever they're found out during the day. And that's, you know, to let listeners know, that's what the Quiet Hour meant. Like every 12 hours, there's an hour, you know, of break where the aliens aren't out and about in the countryside and people can move around safely. But other than that, 1 hour before dawn and 1 hour after sunset, they get hunted, they get vaporized.
Yeah, it's a bit, basically like we vaporize animals when they are in the way. They don't care. The core idea is that they don't care because we are, of course, very self-centered as a species, and we imagine we are worthy of the attention of a much more advanced species, but actually maybe not. And which is a bit disturbing, but it could be that they don't care. They could be around, but not care about us, really. No.
Yeah, we're the idea, and that was always in Stephanie's early drafts, was that we're insignificant to this alien species. In the same way as, you know, a field vole are to a farmer as he or she ploughs their field. You know, the farmer's ploughing the field for corn or whatever it may be, and mice die and other insects and other animals get caught and killed. And, you know, we're probably aware that we're doing that collateral damage, so to speak, but the more important thing is that you get the corn, the harvest, and these smaller creatures that are destroyed in the process is par for the course, so to speak. And from this alien species perspective, that's what the humans mean to them. They're insignificant. And again, that was always in Stephanie's early drafts. But again, it also worked in our favour in terms of doing a film like this on a low budget.
Now, how much research or consulting did you do for people who are survivalists to get the look and the feel of what an your average teenager might be able to manage and sustain during this, I'm going to say, this year of turmoil?
I must admit, I didn't do much research in terms of survival or really. I grew up in the countryside, so I really know the environment, and so which gave me a good idea of what would happen and if I had to survive on a farm for a year on my own. But yeah, I think that's that was basically drawn from my own experience more than any research per se.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, in these types of circumstances, depending on the reason for the apocalypse, whether it's zombies or aliens or just, nuclear war and so on, I think the circumstances would vary depending on the apocalyptic event. In this case, again, because we are insignificant to these creatures, it's more about the humans that are, you know, stealing each other's food and robbing each other's property to survive. And I think, although Stephanie said she didn't do too much research on that, I think of all those potential apocalyptic scenarios like zombies, aliens, or nuclear war, I think this one is probably the most realistic. And I think it's dealt with in a realistic way, given their very isolated on a remote farm, and and they have a shotgun. It's more like the Wild West than.
And they have access to water, clean water, and yeah. They can grow their own food. So that's
and solar panel.
Yeah, solar panels. So they're actually equipped to survive, because it's mentioned that their dad was a survivalist, a fierce survivalist. So hence the solar panels, and he wanted to be off grid if possible. So
And also the story really starts after I'll try not to give too much away for anyone that wants to watch it or hasn't seen it. The story really starts after the young girl and her young brother's father gets killed. So he was really the survivalist, so to speak, for the past year or so, and it's only right as the story begins that these kids have to survive on their own. So they really are at the beginning of figuring out, how are we going to survive now without dad being around, and the mom was killed a little earlier than the dad. So it's although the apocalyptic, the alien invasion is a year old, the actual situation where the kids are now on their own as children without adults around is literally as the story begins in the movie.
And it's, and the story is set in Europe, in UK. So they, even if, although they do have a shotgun, they don't know how to use it. I mean, it's just, they're not really familiar with shotguns, and it's quite alien in a way to European culture. So I guess that's the aspect that actually we struggled with, because nobody even knew how to use these, basically use these weapons when we weren't on set. Obviously they weren't real weapons, but how to make it look like it's real. So that's,
well, they pulled it off quite well, because you see all these stories, in the British countryside, people hunting rabbits all the time, and so the farmers and the people who live out in the country are very familiar.
Yeah, but not yeah, absolutely. But the younger,
they can be.
Yeah,
but,
they can
but,
be.
But the concept, unfortunately, the concept of humans killing each other with guns in most of Europe, certainly in the UK, is radically different than the US, and
yes.
how that's portrayed in movies in the US, where it's more stylistic and ridiculous to a degree, it's exaggerated for effect, of course, in movies, but still. Even in real life in America, with the gun culture, there is an aspect where, many people are killed every day, every week in the US. And in the UK, in Europe, you know, the numbers are, you know, yeah, minute.
And even
in
if your dad is a hunter, then, you know, like that young girl, she wouldn't necessarily know how to use it.
Yeah, sure. Shooting rabbits is a bit different, yeah.
Yeah, so university, probably didn't care too much about hunting. And,
yeah, you wouldn't have, even when it comes to hunting in the UK, you don't have hunters per se with rifles that rarely, you know, that are shooting deer and bigger game, and it's more grouse shooting.
Yeah, grouse shooting. So
it's mostly shotguns. It's not rifles, which are obviously much more accurate, more powerful, more long range than a shotgun. A shotgun is literally just blasting, you know, lead a short distance. It's just radically different all around, I would say, than what you guys would be familiar with in movies.
Yeah, I grew up in the French.
Literally be more like an old Western, actually.
Yeah,
it's a good comparison.
Absolutely. I grew up in the French countryside, and it's the same, right?
Yeah.
People shoot maybe rabbits, but that's about it.
Well, the main thrust of the story seems to be how these kids adjust to strangers sort of invading their world. And it really does become a character story, set against the backdrop of, oh yeah, there are these aliens we have to avoid or they'll kill us. And the realistic behavior of everyone involved was well done. And because you have the nervous new guy who finds himself he thought he was raiding an empty house and there's people here. The sister and the brother don't trust anybody. And you have the marauders who are more than a little scary. They've gone full on into a deeper level of barbarism, let's say.
Yeah.
gonna keep that spoiler free for a moment, because I think people will be both shocked and repelled and intrigued at the same time. But it's something that's happened in other movies, and you're in a survival situation and desperation sets in, and some people choose to go that route.
And it's really like this old question, like how long did it take for our civilization to collapse? And they often say that there are only 4 days of food in supermarkets. So after 4 days, people would start being hungry, and God knows what they would do, right? It's just,
Another good reference, and, you know, we both love the show, so I'm sure Stephanie was inspired by it as well, is The Walking Dead. Because that is a really good sort of, I think, you know, we don't really know, we'll never know unless it happens, but I think it's a good, it seems like an accurate portrayal of how humans would be
in this
apocalyptic world. Again, in that case, zombies, obviously, but in terms of surviving and what one would do to another human being that you wouldn't do in a normal world, but when it comes to surviving, looking after your children, eating, drinking, all these things, you know, it's what's fascinating is the study of that, and The Walking Dead is really about studying humans in that situation more than the zombies itself.
Yeah.
The road too, as well.
Yeah, it's really what, you know, are you going to cross the line or not for your own survival?
There's a theory. I forgot where I read it, but that an economic apocalypse would be far more devastating and far much more harder to recover from than an epidemic or a zombie apocalypse, just because the first thing that most people would attack would be an infrastructure. And without infrastructure, you can't really have global commerce. And global commerce is the only way to get people to start working together again, because everybody wants to make money. And most of the time, corporations lose money when there's a lot of war going on. And that's not good for their bottom line, which makes them grumpy. And makes them want to choose to shall we say, use their influence in other ways. But I would be curious to see what an economic post-apocalyptic film would be about, because that's intriguing.
I would imagine there's some people working on just that type of story right now, you know, in a very clever political way, a kind of, you know, futuristic West Wing or something, you know, that really focuses on those types of scenarios.
Just if the internet were to be shut down for days or weeks, most of society would collapse.
Well, possibly, yeah, we did survive without the internet before it was around, you know, only 20 years
but
ago.
But all the infrastructure is now tied to the internet.
I mean, how many people under the age of 25 rely too much on Google? Would happen if they couldn't get to Google on their cell phones?
How do you grow a carrot? Yeah. Oops.
Yeah. It would make a good comedy, apocalyptic comedy movie, actually.
Where's the seed? Oops.
Yeah. Yeah. Once Twitter's down, that's it. The world is over.
Oh, if Facebook were ever to be down for more than a day, people, I think, would lose their minds.
Yeah, absolutely. And what is it?
But
yeah,
going back to the movie, we're going to segue back. After the movie was made, what was your plan to get it out to film festivals and distribute it? Distributors, there we go. So audiences could take a look at it.
The first goal was to play at some festivals first, because that's the really, for filmmakers, that's the really nice aspect of making, especially the smaller independent films that these days don't necessarily get theatrical release because it's not financially viable, because the companies have to spend so much money on marketing and advertising and so on. And now, because of all these streaming platforms, Netflix especially, these films tend to go straight to DVD, video on demand. So the festival circuit is great for filmmakers because it's where they get to see their film on a big screen with an audience, and where the filmmakers, you know, the actors and writer director especially, are kind of more revered and appreciated than on the other side, the distribution side of things.
Yeah, we wanted to go down that road
first, and because the film did get nominated at several festivals, and we played at very good festivals, then that naturally got us interest from sales agents and distributors.
Yeah, and it's truly especially when you make movies with such a small budget, it's a grueling process. I mean, post-production can be slow and painful, it's rewarding to be able to show the film. It's really an aspect of time where you can finally enjoy the end result.
And share it with all the
cast and
crew.
Because
as I say, I mean, you know, the reality is even films that are made for up to $10 million nowadays, some of these films literally don't have a theatrical release, either because they're not, you know, strong enough or good enough, as it turns out, to warrant spending $20 or $30 million marketing it to do a theatrical, or just because it makes more financial sense to release it on Amazon or Netflix or
similar. And funnily enough, it's actually an American sales agent who picked up the film, Vision Films.
As Stephanie and I independently used to live in, before we knew each other or formed a company together, we both used to live in Los Angeles for a number of years and went to UCLA. You know, it was really nice for us that we ended up having a Los Angeles-based sales agent for the film, Vision Films, Lisa Romanoff at Vision Films, and they've done, you know, a fabulous job in releasing the film. I think it's reached a bigger audience and more countries, and now the US release, than if we'd have had a UK-based sales agent, which would have been more typical for our film, just because it is a UK indie film. So it's fairly typical, I would say, for us with this film to have gotten a US sales agent. But, you know, for us, that's more interesting and more exotic than having a UK-based one. And we're very happy with how the film is unfolding in that respect, distribution.
And have you been getting a lot of feedback from this side of the pond now that it's starting to play here?
It's early days. I think it was literally just released, so not mm-hmm. at the moment. You know, we had a couple of good reviews and some comments left on various platforms. So I think that, you know, I think people will, provided they, you know, appreciate it was a film made for, you know, the catering budget of most typical...
the coffee budget.
yeah. I think, you know, it shows great vision. It shows, you know, fantastic writing and directing skills from Stephanie. I think, you know, we got very talented young actors. They're all, you know, really very talented and will have fantastic careers if the planets align for them, as these things have to do sometimes. But Dakota Blue Richards, I mean, she was the young girl from...
The Golden Compass, right?
Golden Compass, yeah.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, she can have an amazing career. She's still very, very young and very talented. But again, and these actors elevate the sum of the parts we had to make this film.
Well, it's funny, I guess now, because it's such a long journey for us, we are really eager to move on to the next project and be on set again, making a new movie. So
we're ready to make our next film.
Yeah.
Do you?
We're very, very happy that this is new and refreshing for us to have this US release
absolutely.
Now, because as I say, we've already played the festival circuit. That's finished, you know, 6 or more months ago now. Perhaps even a year ago, it got released in the UK and some other territories in Europe. And now in the US release is a new, fresh situation. So we're very excited about that and very happy about that. Nonetheless, we are ready to get going on our next film, which I wrote and will direct and Stephanie will produce. So we basically rotate. We're both individually writer directors who formed a production company together to produce their own material instead of waiting by the phone for producers and so on. I mean, we partner with producers, of course, but we are very active as writer directors in terms of producing. So we're currently financing our next film. As I said, Stephanie will produce that or be the main producer on it and I wrote and will direct it. And then Stephanie is eager to do her next film as well, which is also a sci-fi film.
Yeah, this one is about global warming.
Yeah.
Quite topical as well.
Another small little subject.
Natural budget.
So the new one you're working on now, what genre is that?
The one I wrote and will direct, it's a sci-fi horror film. It's not... too far away from The Quiet Hour in terms of setting, and it's another family scenario and another alien invasion. But on this occasion, it's literally about the aliens and the conflict they cause with against humans and how the humans and a family will survive in that scenario. And it's a unique concept because it's literally an alien race that black out the sun with giant fibrous organic shields around the whole world. So there's also the scenario where the world will slowly be dying because of lack of photosynthesis. So it's a perpetually dark world, and it's about a particular family surviving in that scenario. So that it's a twofold challenge. You've got the alien creatures, which are predatorial, and you've also got the fall in temperatures, the lack of light, and all those scenarios that you have to deal with.
And it's set in a very romantic English moors.
The Yorkshire moors, yeah, in the UK.
So, awesome.
Yeah, we're putting that together now. We hope to shoot that in the summer. And then and start moving on to Stephanie's next film. So we're kind of on a roll at the moment.
Awesome. Well, thank you for such a lively, lovely discussion today.
Thank you so much.
The movie is The Quiet Hour. It is available throughout North America on video on demand and DVD. We'll have links to some places where you can catch it. But Stephanie Joelland and Sean McConville, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you, wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa. The first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award, with weekly stories from the world's best authors. Michael Moorcock, Peter Watts, Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more, with news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pohl, Wolf, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
Hey guys, this is Arjun Gupta from Sci-Fi's The Magician. You are listening to Slice of Sci-Fi.
As I've always said, I love talking to indie filmmakers, and this this conversation went a lot longer than what we had what we have here in the episode. But yeah, this film isn't your typical post-apocalyptic movie where things are blowing up and there are great big chases. This is all about figuring out who to trust, if you can trust anybody, and where you find the hope to keep going when it seems like there's really nothing left to keep going for. It's a short film, comes in at about 85 minutes. So if you get a chance, go check it out. It is available on Amazon right now. The DVD of it doesn't come out until March 21st, so you've got a little ways to wait for that. But I can't wait to see what they come out with next. Stephanie and Sean are definitely making their own footprint in the indie sci-fi slash horror realm. So I can't wait to see what their next little sci-fi horror movie is. I can't wait to see what their next apocalyptic horror or apocalyptic sci-fi is. I will be waiting to see what their next project is, and the project after that, and the one after that. A few schedule updates regarding this show. I'm probably going to be offline for 2 or 3 weeks. Not sure. It might only be 2, but I'm moving, and it's a long distance move. And there is already one more show in the can, but after that, things are going to have to wait till I get settled. So we'll have fun with that. We'll still be posting movie reviews and special things. Check out the interview that Rhonda did with 3 of the new Power Rangers. That video is posted on Slice of Sci-Fi and over on our YouTube channel. She got to talk to the Pink Ranger, the Black Ranger, and the Red Ranger. I think in the movie, their names are Jason, Kimberly, and Zach. Yeah. Naomi Scott, Ludi Lin, and Dacre Montgomery. Really, really fun interview. I'm looking forward to seeing this movie now. because they are just as charming and engaging and full of pranks as young people should be, especially when dealing with something like Power Rangers. I mean, you're ultimately, yeah, there's adventure, there's intrigue, there's drama, but there's also fun. So I'm looking forward to Power Rangers. I'm looking forward to Kong Skull Island. And I will be checking out Logan soon because we have a difference of opinion. We're going to have a reviewer cage match or something. Rhonda loved Logan. Noah and Darren did not. They did not enjoy Logan at all. So we're going to discuss. I don't know if I'll have to be a referee or not, but I loved what I saw in the trailer. And like Noah and Darren, I'm an old school X-Men fan, you know? And they were unhappy with what they perceived was a big middle finger to the older X-Men fans like us. So I'm just going to have to go see the movie and find out. And of course, we'll talk about it. But that'll do it for this episode. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to call in. The number is 602-635-6976. Leave a message, ask a question, or if you just want to email in your questions or comments, the place to send those is summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and on Krypton Radio. If you're listening on iTunes or Stitcher, leave us a review, give us a rating. Every little bit helps because every review helps because it lets people know that, hey, you enjoy the show and maybe they should check it out and see if they like it too. Follow us on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi. Check us out on YouTube and Google Plus. We're Slice of Sci-Fi over there. And of course, we have the websites, sliceofscifi.com, writersafterdark.com, and popculturegeeks.com. Thank you, everyone, for your pledges and donations. Every dime you pledge helps keep this show going, helps keep the websites online, helps keep the media for the shows flowing. Yes, the audio for Slice of Sci-Fi, the video for Slice of Sci-Fi TV, and the soon-to-be-coming-your-way audio for Writers After Dark. So thank you, everyone, for your support. If you would also like to join in and support the shows that we're doing here, you can do that through Patreon. The URL is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. I'd also like to give my heartfelt thanks and a hearty shout out to the geek rock band Sci-Fried for their musical contribution here on this show. Thanks, guys. The theme, I've loved it since day one. I think this was the second demo they sent me. I'm a rock and roll girl. I love this music. I really do. If you want to listen to more music by them or maybe buy an album or two, head on over to their website, sci-fried.com. And that'll do it for now, but we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.